On this episode of On the Bridge, I'm chatting with
Lee and Giles from Ockham Marine.
Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Morning.
Thank you for having us in your very lovely office this morning.
They're nice, aren't they?
All designed by you guys as well.
And Elsa and Aaron. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So credit to them.
The golf was us.
Yeah, I can imagine the golf was you.
Golf and coffee machine.
Yeah, the important things.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to start with asking you both about your careers before coming ashore. So Lee, let's start with you. Tell me about your career pre-Ockham Marine.
Well, I grew up in Kent on the coast, sailed dinghies as a child. And then my dad got me into keelboat racing. We campaigned a half tonner and a three quarter tonner to quite a good level. And then I went off to university, stopped sailing, got myself a law degree, then fell into banking, did banking for 5 years. Woke up one day and realized I hadn't been traveling. Didn't really enjoy driving a desk, so fell back on my yacht master certificate, which I already had. Went and did a bunch of courses at UKSA over in Cowes, and then got offered my first job as a deckhand second engineer on a 50-meter sailboat. So that was in 2002.
So quite a career change. I didn't know that that's what you did before you went to sea.
You're here to learn new things.
Yeah, I know.
So, very lucky, Goldman said, look, take a one-year sabbatical. Go and do your thing, get out your system. So I went and got a job, had a great year. We were busy charter boat, loved it. Went back exactly a year to the day that I resigned, if you like, and said, look, sorry, I've had a great year, I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, you know, amazing. You know, you're very lucky you can do that at your stage in your life with no kids. So yeah, and the rest was history. And then spent the next 20 years operational yachting.
So you're both at sea and as a build captain.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I sort of jumped between sailing yachts and motor yachts. Just wanted to progress my career as quickly as I could in terms of getting the right amount of sea time with the right amount of experience to sort of marry up with the qualification. And then, yeah, I think I managed to get involved in 6 builds during my 20 years of operational yachting. 2 of them were Giles, hence our long-standing relationship to where we've come today. And then my last yacht was a 90-meter Fed ship, which I was the build captain on for 2 years, Zen, which I left 3 years ago. 3 years ago this month. And I felt like I left on a high. It was a great boat, great build, really good crew, nice owner, just a great package to finish
on.
Timing was right. You know, we just had our first child, and the thought of 6 months away from him a year was just didn't sit very well with me. And Giles and myself have been talking about Ockham Marine for a while, been cultivating the idea. And Giles is already ashore doing his thing with a big build project. I kind of came ashore with a bit of a parachute with the build, and Ockham Marine was kind of formed, wasn't it, 3 years ago?
3 very busy years ago.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to come on to that in a minute. But Giles, can you give me a brief rundown of your career? Although it's difficult to be brief, isn't it?
No, I can be super brief. I mean, my first career, weirdly, was in industrial catering. And industrial catering.
You're two are dark horses, aren't you?
Industrial catering design. So I worked for quite a large company in the south of England, and we set up industrial kitchens for industry. So, you know, like if Vauxhall wanted to open a new factory, we'd do the kitchen design and we would sometimes run it or sometimes just hand over to somebody else. So my job was a lot of organization, a lot of management. I had to know how to cook as well. So there was a basis of that where you had to understand what all the chefs are doing and get involved as well. So, but as well as that, we also used to do very large event planning, which, you know, transpired into a future career. And then like Lee, at the age of about 21 or so, or maybe almost 20, all my friends were off traveling and I had quite a responsible job and didn't get much time to enjoy myself because it was just a lot of management. So I took a year off and went to Australia. And then while I was there, because as a kid, I used to sell dinghies also. I grew up in Southport, which is a seaside town in the northwest, home of the 24-hour yacht race. So we used to do that once a year, do 24-hour.
So you were already interested?
Well, I mean, until the age I was 14, and then I discovered girls probably, and the sailing took a backseat. And but I left that town at quite an early age to go down to do this job when I was like 17, 18, and that was my, you know, preeminent years. So yeah, I went to Australia and I traveled around quite a bit there and then ended up at a place called Ellie Beach. And I got a job on an old square rigger doing camping safaris out in Thwaites Sunday Islands, whereby we could take like 40 guests on board the boat and we'd sail to an island, set up a camp, and I was in charge of the camp cooking. So I would then organize all the food on board, take it ashore, camp cook, very basic, you know. It's like barbecues, bride or Barbies, as the Australians call them. And because I knew a bit about sailing anyway, I got involved with the sailing as well and really enjoyed that. And then when that finished, I started working on an old pocket maxi that we used to take people out to do sail training and teach them how to race a little bit. Again, that was just me and a captain. So I was deckhand, engineer, cook, whole nine yards. And then after a while of doing that, I got my first commercial ticket in Australia. And then I got my first captain's job in Australia, running a little, very small sailing boat, doing sail racing charters. And we used to race Hamilton Race Week, all of the local racing. And then I decided to come back to Europe, mainly because I'd outstayed my welcome in Australia, had a year's working visa, and I left 4 years later.
Oh.
So at some stage I had to leave.
Yeah, before they threw you out.
And then when I got back to Europe, I realized there was a bit of an industry over here. So I gave it a go and I sailed over to Antigua, got some work over there, sailed back from Antigua, and then just started in the industry on this side of the world, probably about 94, 95. Was lucky enough because I'd already got my commercial ticket. So my commercial ticket that I got in Australia was something that didn't exist in Europe at that time. You could run a very large boat with no tickets then.
Oh, right.
Yeah, though, you know, the commercial tickets that they exist today didn't exist then. So when I came over here with a commercial ticket, I was a bit of a rarity. So I very quickly got jobs as captain on smaller boats and then chief officer on a bigger boat, and then got lucky enough to end up running and Lee loves this story, running a big 53-meter schooner, and I sailed that around the world for 9 years, having a fantastic time. Met my wife on board. And then when that came to sell, the broker that helped sell it, once he sold the boat, I was taking 6 months off with my then girlfriend, soon to be my fiance wife. And we went around the world for 6 months, and then the broker called me eventually and said, I've got a boat that needs a really good guy to come and help build it. There's a very good client and I'd like to come and do it. So I ended up doing that in Turkey, met Lee, who came to help me on that. So we built it. It was a bit of a disaster, simply because by the time we got involved, the contract was signed, specification was done. We were just there really to get the boat operational. Yeah. So from a quality point of view, it wasn't great. So I didn't feel I could hand it on to anybody else. So I stayed a while. Then when I was leaving, I said to the client, right, job done, I'm off. He said, no, why don't you hang around? We're going to build a new boat, I'd like you to do it. So that's what I did. And we built the second Odessa. And then same story. I ran it for a couple of years, make sure all the systems were in place, and then decided to start thinking about leaving. And he said, well, we're going to build another boat, so let's do that. So there you go, very,
so
very briefly.
No. Boats.
Well, we're still building that boat for him. So the third boat is about a year away. And so when Lee was ready to come ashore, I was a couple of years into that build. It's a very long and complex project. But when Lee was ready to come ashore, I'd already been working on that for about 3 years. So we teamed up. And Lee, as you said, he parachuted in with a build that he had. I had my build, and that's how we started.
So you hit the ground running, really, because the next question was going to be, how did you know it was the right time to come ashore? But actually, naturally for you, that already had happened. And then you guys had this working relationship. You knew you could work well together anyway. And then, like you say, your family circumstances perhaps pushed you into coming ashore at that time. And then organically, the company started, which is probably the best way a company can ever start.
Yeah, and I think we were very lucky. You know, it was a period that was kind of fueled by that post-COVID demand for yachts, you know.
Yeah, COVID, the wild time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, COVID really sort of highlighted the fact that, you know, yachts do give, you know, owners an isolated platform where they can bubble up if they need to. And we didn't know if we're going to get more COVID period. So I think there was that initial demand for more yachts. And we kind of rode that little wave for the last 3 years.
We've been very,
very lucky. So, yeah.
Great. So the timing was perfect. Okay. What in your mind makes Ocker Marine different to the other build consultancies out there?
I think primarily is the fact that most people work here have been operational. So we're all ex-ops. And in our experience, that if you've got a pure technical management company, then they could be purely technical guys, either surveyors or engineers. So they understand how to put a boat together and how to work with the shipyard, but they may not know all of the nuances of what makes a good boat from an operational point of view, and certainly from a guest point of view. And what we saw happening was that they would manage the build, and as you get into the last stages of it, not a great deal of thought had been given to the operational setup, whether it's guest separation from the crew, or whether it's just the small nuances of how to make things more efficient. And ditto with the large management companies, they were probably the same, very good technical guys. very good managers, but they missed that operational side of things. So I think that what makes us a little bit different to everybody else, that we have the technical guys in-house. We have, yeah, sure. You know, we also know how to manage things, but it's just those nuances that if we can get in early enough, hopefully pre-contract, while we're still negotiating the contract specification, we can add that value on the operational side of things that other companies probably don't look at.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say on some of the builds that you worked on, when you'd gone in and they'd gone past that point, that then when it came to delivery, you felt that you wanted to pass over the operations in a way that you'd experience it yourself, rather than just saying, okay, it's built, there you go. And that's unusual, because often when the build is done, the team then leave and a captain comes in. So you've got the experience all the way through.
All the way through.
And also you've probably learned from other people's mistakes and maybe your own mistakes as you go along, what really works and what makes a captain chief officer's job as easy as possible, and what makes experience good. Whereas I guess a lot of people start there, finish there, and then there's a whole bit afterwards, you know, that maybe there's no continuation on.
I mean, you don't learn much from a perfect boat.
No, but you don't learn from anything perfect, do you? We only really learn when things don't go right.
It's one of the primary reasons that we thought it'd be a good idea to start the business, is because we saw that gap.
Yeah, and I totally, the last build I did, I joined 2 years before handover, and you think you can come and make operational changes, but you can't. Yeah. You know, the boat's done. There's no more hot work. There's no more changes. There's no more increasing costs or time. So you're coming in accepting what's been delivered, yeah, and making that operational. And you can't be the guy that comes in and says, that's not great, that needs improving, that's a bit crap. Yeah. You know, you've got to come in and go, wow, this is amazing, I'm so happy to be part of this. But then you've got to
make the best of it.
And you've got to operate it in front of the owner, you know, from day one. So, you know, I felt like I inherited quite a few boats weren't completely operationally bulletproof. You know, tenders that you couldn't launch if there was slightly bad weather.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm talking a couple of foot of swell, which is nothing, on a big boat. And it's like, well, that's not great. So I think what we're trying to achieve at Ockham is, you know, the compounding of lots and lots of small operational improvements during the course of that design, which ultimately gives the crew the best possible platform to operate that boat. Yeah. You know, designers come in, they do their thing. We don't really get involved in that. We try and help them with, you know, the operational input that they might need. But it's all the stuff behind the scenes that we're hopefully really adding value.
Yeah, the detail.
Yeah,
for sure. And I think any business, when you start a business, you're solving a problem ultimately that maybe the owner doesn't even know they have. And what you've just both said sums it up. You're solving the problem that there was this gap between building and operating. And perhaps, you know, owners would go and design a boat and it looks amazing and it's what they've dreamed of. But then, like you say, they get on, they want their kids to get on. Oh no, we can't launch.
Yeah.
And they've just spent all this money on the boat. But from experience, you guys know physically what doesn't work. So you're building a boat that's going to be as operationally perfect as possible.
Yeah, you know, and if we can get involved, you know, at that very early stage, you know, blank sheet of paper almost with the designers, you know, then we stand quite a good chance of getting across some of our, you know, our input. You know, it's still a fine line fighting that, the sure, design input and aesthetics and operational, you know, efficiencies. You know, that's that sort of tightrope we walk all the time on every project. But hopefully the way that we get that across with good case study examples of stuff that's actually happened to us operationally and the rest of the team, you know, we've got 260 years of operational experience in the office, and it's, you know, everyone's bringing an example of how something might not work very well or why that worked particularly well on that yacht. And if we can sort of crowbar all of that into the design, then fantastic.
Yeah, high value to end up with the best project you can.
The client, once he's spent X amount of money on a yacht, doesn't want to hear from his captain or chief officer or head of the department why they can't do something and why that was a bad idea and why this is a bad design. Because first of all, the client will have probably picked the shipyard and the designer. So they probably take it as a direct reflection on their decision-making process. So you really don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What you want is always have a happy client, not just for us, because it's good for our business.
Of course.
It's good for the industry. Yeah. You know, we're all just little cogs in a big spinning wheel. And what you don't want is to have a client who at the end of a bill thinks, I'm not going through that again.
Yeah. And ends up selling the boat and leaving the industry.
Yeah.
Okay. What have you found to be some of the most challenging parts of becoming business owners and growing the business to where it is now? And what have been the best experiences and lessons you've learned?
I think, quite frankly, the what was that?
Paying tax.
Okay. Just generally, yeah, like, that's a bad experience.
Yeah.
Weirdly, from starting the business to now has been incredibly easy. Weirdly.
I love that.
And I think that's...
Touch wood, it stays like
that. Well, yeah, I say from here to now because now we've got to go to the next stage. So yeah. Between starting and now, we've been lucky enough to... Over our years, we've forged these amazing relationships with people in the industry. And I think once we've come ashore, we've taken that profit, if you like. And yeah. So people have entrusted us. We've been recommended to clients. And so the work has come quite easily. We're running 6 big projects at the moment, which has allowed us to grow the business quite quickly without worrying too much about, you know, our P&L going forward. And so we've gone from working in Lee's barn, just the two of us, to... I mean, we're not a huge company, but we're 12 full-time employees and a few consultants
as well.
In 3
years, that's
it is, and yeah, and we've been lucky enough to run in profit every year since we started. However, now, because all of that goodwill that we've had before, we've still got it, but we've taken it, well, not take advantage of it.
Taken most of the profit.
Yeah, yeah, we've made the best of that, but now we're at a stage with the company where if you're not growing, you're going backwards. So now we've still got to grow. We still need more projects. And so the challenging bit now is how we do that. How do we still keep the projects coming in? How do we keep them profitable while still growing?
And staff all those projects.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then how do we find other revenue streams?
Yeah.
So most businesses, I think, find the first 3 years incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
We found it incredibly easy. I think we're going to find the next 3 years more difficult.
But if you can start the first 3 years like that, then that is, I think, 50% of, you know, the worry.
I think we're quite fortunate with the business model that we're involved in. You know, it's a fixed monthly revenue for 4 years.
Yeah.
If we take on an entire build. So it's an easier model to plan for.
Yes.
So, you know, we've got fixed income for 4 years per project. So you can scale your business accordingly.
Yeah.
And I think that's for that side of the business has been quite straightforward.
Yeah.
This year is the first year we've sort of made some strategic hires in a view of winning more business.
Right.
So we wanted to be geared, ready for that new business, yeah, rather than being reactive, which we have been for the last 3 years of the yeah company.
And they also, when good people come along in this industry, you want to sort of pinch them when you can, rather yeah than wait and think, right, I really need to hire 2 really good whatever. If you see someone maybe making a move, you want to grab them because they're likely to get snapped up quite quickly.
Which we've done, absolutely right. In fact, our last 2 hires have been exactly that.
Yeah.
That we've been approached. We weren't particularly looking for anybody, yeah, but we've been approached and we met with an open mind and thought, you know what, they'll be great for us
yeah
in the future. We don't necessarily need them right now, but I think it'd be a good strategic hire. But, you know, the other thing is that everybody in the office has already worked on new builds. Everyone's got that experience. Everyone's yeah launched new builds. But Ockham, as an entity, hasn't launched one yet because we're only 3 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Our first launch is going to be in October this year, and then we have another one in February of next year and another one June.
So that'll be another stage of the business,
yeah,
then, because at the moment you haven't reached that point, so that will be another
So it's also a point where we've got to plan for them not being here anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you start thinking about how you might be able to extend the revenue that comes in from by various mm-hmm services, and that's the stage we're going through at the moment.
What I think, though, is important when you provide your service so well is that the owner and the team trust you. And therefore, then if you do decide to launch other revenue streams, you already have their trust.
Yeah.
For sure, I know if we do a good job, the crew come back to us for yeah other things and they trust our opinion on things. And that is so much more valuable than big fancy advertising campaigns or anything. It's just doing a good job.
Absolutely.
And it's so surprising how many companies don't do a good yeah job, and they're short-sighted by thinking, oh, we're going to get all this money, take all this money, and they do a half-assed job and then they lose that client. So they're coming in fast through the front door, but yeah they're going out fast out the back door.
You know, if we're asked what we want to achieve for Ockham as a business, all we want is that at the end of the build, when the boat's delivered, if anybody asks them, would you use Ockham again?
Yeah.
It's a resounding yes.
What is one thing you wish you'd known before you started your business?
I think what we're finding out right now, we're 3 years in, is we've been so buried in the business, the 2 of us. We've now taken on a business mentor this year, and he's really teaching us to work on the business, not within the business.
Right.
And I think for me, that's been one of the big takeaways so far. you know, when we both started the business, we took on project management roles ourselves.
Yeah.
We're coming to the end of those projects now within the next sort of 12, 18 months. And we want to not take on that role again.
Yeah.
But work more strategically within the business, you know, on business development and building the team and working on branding.
Because when you start, you have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
The project manager, the person who organizes toilet roll in the bathroom, you're everything.
Absolutely.
And then as it grows, you naturally can step away.
But just recognizing that we're now at that sort of fulcrum of stepping away from the day-to-day projects. You know, I'm not very good at detail, so I'm totally the wrong person to be looking after a project, whereas the guys we've hired are the right people to be looking after the project, whereas we enjoy naturally the business development and, you know, finding the right, you know, scaling the business, finding the right people.
Yeah, and the longevity then, if you two recognise already that you're at a point where your job has changed from the first day that you started, that already is positive.
Yeah.
And you're not going to stagnate the company growing.
I think one thing that would have been good to recognise at the beginning is that from our old jobs being operational, we always had a very good relationship with the clients we were working for, the owners of the boat and the family offices, and that you always had that direct contact pretty much whenever you needed it.
Yeah.
And then when you come to this side of the business, we understand very well that they are ring-fenced and there's a circle of trust there, and that's quite hard to break into. So I don't think I recognised right at the beginning that I'm not going to have that direct contact with the client that we used to do. And it hasn't made it difficult. It just takes time to earn the trust of the family offices and anybody else who might be involved in the business. And I think if I'd thought about that before, we may have had different strategies of how to communicate, perhaps in a different way, that we could earn that trust a lot quicker.
Sure.
Because it does pave the way for a smoother project.
Yeah, because I guess there's more people in between each party in this situation than there would be if you're captaining the boat.
A client he can be in his office, wherever it is, and he can have thousands of calls coming in, meetings to go to. But normally, if his operational captain gives him a call, he's going to answer it straight away.
I don't blame him, I would too. What are the considerations when taking on a project? So things like the customer, what are they looking for? And are there some projects that you wouldn't take on based on what you're trying to achieve here?
Yeah, we profile every proposal we get asked to put forward, we will profile the client, the shipyard, the designers, the key decision makers around that client, just to see. And then we grade them very crudely, A, B, C.
Yeah.
We try not to take on the C's as a company. We haven't had to yet.
Yeah.
So, and I think all of our projects so far are A's, within our matrix, if you like. And that's a very crude way of just giving us a bit of an indication straight away if it's a red, amber, or green client, and then we work the proposal around that, if you like, you know.
So I think it's also important to recognize that you're not always going to get the makeup of the owner's team that you might possibly want.
Right.
And with our experience, I think we can recognize that quite quickly, that let's just say, for example, they're so disorganized and they're very naive about what it is they're trying to achieve, whether it's what shipyard they're at and what price they're trying to achieve or the makeup of the team. You know, we could say that we don't think, it doesn't matter what we do on this, I don't think it's going to be a particularly successful project. And do we want to, in 4 years' time, have our name on that? And so I would say we've never knocked back a project yet, but we have dodged a couple of bullets that we recognise now that perhaps at the time we were just doing our best to get as much as possible. But in hindsight, we dodge bullets. And I think that's taught us now for the future that what the red flags are as we're being approached by somebody, and we take them very seriously, those red flags.
There's quite some foresight for people who've never run a company before, though, to have that sort of standing from the start and recognising that ultimately, as a new company, you might want to take on a new business, but actually it's not going to be able to be delivered the quality that you want to represent you, that you're actually just going to swerve it. Because most people who start a business are just like, great, a new project.
I know, it's very difficult to turn away business. It really is.
It really is.
But when you look back and go, okay, we definitely kind of, whether it's conscious or subconsciously, made the right decision there.
But we have been fortunate enough to have fantastic projects on our books right now. And every one of those is going to be a huge success.
Yeah. Which is enjoyable also from a point of view, actually, working.
It's exciting.
Something. Yeah, there's nothing worse than trying to sort of make something into something that it's never going to be, and knowing that the outcome is going to be disappointing for you and
the journey's got to be enjoyable, you know, and I think ultimately that's how that goes into our grading as well. You know, is this going to be a fun project?
Yeah.
You know, are we surrounded by people that we want to work with?
Yeah.
You know, are we working at a collaborative shipyard with collaborative designers? Are we going to be able to give our input as a company? Otherwise, you know, why employ Ocker Marine if we're not going to be able to give that operational input and have that accepted? You know, otherwise they might just employ just a one-man band technical manager, if you like, or...
Yeah, so you have a great team of people here at Ockham. What are your non-negotiables when you're looking for a new member of your team?
You know, I guess from our ex-operational days, yachting was fun. You know, I had a lot of fun, you know, a lot of bands from the bridge with the guys and, you know, enjoy being on deck. I think, you know, look around the office now, no one takes themselves too seriously. I think just surrounding yourself, we're not curing cancer, we're building super yachts.
Yeah, you know. Holidays for billionaires.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, some integrity, trust. You know, these guys are wearing our hats when they're representing us in shipyards in front of clients, you know, and to get that feedback from a client that we're doing a good job, you know, for those projects that we're not directly involved in, and hearing that about the guys on the ground, that reinforces that we're making the right hiring decisions.
Yeah.
So, and as we would if we were, you know, employing operational crew, you know, it's all about client experience. It's all about people. It's all about the touch points with people.
Yeah.
You know, we don't make anything. We're a people-based business.
Yeah.
So just surrounding ourselves with people that we think fit that Ockham framework.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start. We'll talk a little bit now about the actual design process, because obviously I'm intrigued also about the bridge and sort of that part of the vessel. How do you start the design process for a bridge, looking at things like practicality, compliance, and also the customer's expectations of what the vessel needs to look like and what it's going to be used for?
I guess on those projects where we've got a blank sheet of paper, which is the dream for us, to get in at the ground level. You know, we have a standard as a company for a build. We have our Ockham standard, which is evolving, and we have that standard for the bridge. And I think, you know, for us, it's some basic stuff that we've, again, not had on various builds. You know, good sight lines, you know, being able to, actual visibility out the window seems like a very common sense thing to say, but it's amazing, and we're still seeing it now, where you're not having to rely on cameras for good seamanship. Just those basics for me. Let's call windows for backscatter. We try and, you know, efficiencies like multifunctional workstations, which are fully integrated, but in the event that they do go down, you've got that black box autonomy to be able to still use a piece of equipment. That's super important for us. You know, we like the look of an uncluttered foil integrated bridge, but if you can't use that bridge in anger because the foil's gone down or you've lost a section of the foil and you don't have that redundancy, that for us is not great.
Yeah.
So making sure that redundancy is there, but it still looks great and streamlined. Single button dimming, little things like that. You know, I've been on bridges where it might take 15, 20 button pushes to dim the bridge down at night.
Right.
And again, we still see that as a standard. It's just like, well, that's not, you know, we've moved on from that.
So again, it's just drawing on your own personal experiences of boats you've been on where things weren't as practical as they could be, and sort of learning each build through things at work.
It gets a little bit tricky because the bridge is the primary place on the boat where design meets function.
Yeah.
Because it's got to be beautiful, but it's got to work beautifully. And the guests like coming onto the bridge, and so it's a luxury space.
Yeah.
But it's actually one of the most, you know, it's the working center of the boat as well. So it's not like the engine room. The galley a little bit is the same, but not in the same way that the bridge is. And so for us, it's function over form.
Yeah.
But you've also got to give the designers their lead to be able to do the beautiful side of it.
Yeah.
And that's where it's important that we get the designers' trust with our experiences, that we can help them make it beautiful, but also still very functional. And, you know, we're talking about things about not having blinking lights that you see in the window in front of you, because the surfaces behind you or the surfaces on the deckheads aren't exactly the right surfaces, or the way they've set up the lighting in there is completely impractical. There's so many small things that we can get involved in. Luckily, they leave the technical side of it to us with the actual Navcom's equipment. But for us, that's the super important thing, is to have that relationship with the designer.
Yeah, and also, I guess, if there's a build captain in place, obviously, that you know is going to stay with the vessel once it's launched, you have someone to collaborate with, in the sense that they'll, and if they know the owner, they'll know what the vessel's going to be used for and how it's going to be used. But if there isn't, then it is sort of down to you guys to sort of make decisions that will ultimately decide how the captain is going to use the bridge. And that's sort of quite a big decision and important to get right.
And having that incumbent captain can be good. Well, normally is good, but can also be detrimental.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, they come, you know, maybe they're stepping up for size-wise on boat and they're bringing their ideas from their previous boat, or they're going for sailing to motor yacht or vice versa. You know, and we're trying to sort of explain to them that, although it worked really well in their last boat, think about maybe this for this boat, you know, and just having that. But again, that comes down to the style, the, how we operate. You know, we're not all guns blazing. We're just, you know, this is sow the seeds. And if, you know, hopefully stuff resonates with that captain. And again, it's about building trust, you know, with that captain as well as all the other stakeholders.
Yeah.
I mean, we like to think that if there is no build captain involved and we're actually doing the setup of the bridge and the design of the bridge with the designers, we like to think that any bridge that has been under our control, any captain could come on and be happy to operate. Because it's important, because the captains are always going to move on.
Of course.
They're not going to be there for the life of the boat. That bridge is going to serve 3, 4, 5, 6, a dozen captains. And so it's got to be done in such a way that it's practical for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things Lee touched on is it can be detrimental having a crew there. Not always, obviously. Crew absolutely can bring a huge amount to the table. But what we do see is that it does get personalized a little bit. And that's not the right way to design a bridge. It's not the right way to design a galley either. It's not the right way to design an engine room. It can't be personalized. It's got to be practical for absolutely everybody into the future.
You know, we love it when we get to that stage of a project where we're actually designing the console. You know, we get everything one-to-one, we lay it out, we ergonomically work out if we can touch everything, you know, and we all go through it. You know, we've got tons of experience in the office, you know, and let everyone drive it, you know, on paper.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
and it evolves. Like, actually, that might not work. And it might be something that you guys hadn't noticed. Or...
Absolutely. Yeah. You get blinkered, as you know, when you're, you know, when you're so immersed in a project. So it's good to get the other guys to take on it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. That was really interesting.
You're so
learning
welcome.
All about you two and your previous career. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for being here.